Well, good afternoon and welcome to Talk of the Towns. We try to go beyond the headlines to make sense of the issues facing Maine communities, to share what works and to seek alternative solutions. Talk of the Towns is aired on WERU Community Radio since 1993, dedicated to the proposition that everyone benefits when we share our knowledge, our experience, our concerns, and our perspectives. We're about to practice the magic of community radio, in which those of us in our virtual studio and you who are listening create a kind of dialogue that we hope will be of benefit to our friends, our neighbors, and colleagues. We're your hosts, Ron Beard and Liz Graves. We hope you'll stay with us for the next hour and Talk of the Towns. And just a reminder that we are recording this show in advance and won't be taking any calls today. Well, we hear a good deal about the challenge of housing costs throughout Maine, especially in the coastal region. And private sector programs are helping to make housing more affordable for working families. But really, since the New Deal and perhaps before the New Deal helping to end the Great Depression, the federal government has provided housing assistance to those at the lower end of the economic scale. And we're going to explore that topic with our guest today. Weston Bream is the executive director of the Mount Desert Island and Ellsworth Housing Authorities. And Michael Myhat is the executive director of Bangor Housing. Welcome to both of you. Glad you could be with us today. Perhaps you could each, starting with Weston, give us a little bit of your own background. How did you get into the work of helping people with public housing? Weston?
Well, you're opening a door here for me, Ron. I could talk on this for a long time. I'll try to give the quick version. I was in college and I was working at the Center of Community Research and Consulting at Bloomsburg University in central Pennsylvania. I started getting my feet wet within various agencies that serve the communities, Chamber of Commerce, Visitors Bureau, the municipal governments, just doing general research projects and focus group facilitation. Got me involved with the Columbia County Housing and Redevelopment Authorities and in helping to create some housing summits and forums and things. And upon graduating from college, I jumped in with that agency as a data analyst and IT manager. So I was tasked with basically assessing all of their operations, implementing IT solutions to create efficiencies, assessing all of their programs. All of this work allowed me a window to become familiar with what the processes were and what exactly everybody was doing. I quickly then evolved. The opportunity came up to become a community development specialist. I jumped on it, was in that role for 2 years, and then became the deputy executive director. That I was in that role for another 2 years, and an opportunity came up to become the executive director of a housing authority. At that point, I had been mainly working in community development work, managing community development block grant funding, some disaster recovery funding, and various federal programs. And it was really complicated work. It was a lot of facilitating with municipal representatives. Pennsylvania is quite different. It has a county government. So the municipalities, I worked with 33 municipalities down there. So jumping into the housing authority world was a little bit of a break from what I had been deep within in the community development world. It was great. Again, it was basically me developing processes, creating efficiencies within the context of regulation and statutory law. And that's something I thrive in. So That led me here.
I'm going to back you up. Before, what interests got you into those internships or whatever you were working on in college in the first place? What, when you were a little kid, did you say, I want to be in community development? Like, how did that happen?
At different times, I had had to defend my group of friends who we were skateboarders in a small town. This is interesting, right? And we would at times get harassed by residents or somebody driving down the road. Get out of the road, you know, you're always in the way. And we're just kids trying to have fun. And at some point, somebody said, you know, you really should learn about the rules of this town. So I did. I went and learned about, I got the ordinances and studied them. And when folks would start coming at us, including police at times, I would recite ordinances and protect my group of friends. And so this idea of protecting vulnerable populations has always been with me since I was a kid. I did go to school for sociology, and community studies. Now, I guess you could say I'm responsible for vulnerable populations on a whole another level, right?
Mike, how about your own background? How did you get involved in the world of public housing?
Yeah, I think I heard you. First, thanks for having me on. Ron, I think in the beginning, I think I heard you say you went to the University of Maine. I also went to the University of Maine and graduated with a degree in public management, public administration. And I really, really thought I wanted to be a town manager. And one of the things that I had to do before graduating, and that was actually the last piece, was I was lucky enough to get an internship working for Peter Crichton at the city of Lewiston. Didn't really know much about community development, didn't really know much about housing other than just experiences from just growing up. And man, once I was in it, was just fell in love with the idea of building neighborhoods and working with neighborhood groups to see what works best for them. And then this was in the late 90s, 98, 99. And if you remember back then, it was all about really redeveloping the Bates Mill. In Lewiston, there were so many abandoned and dilapidated old homes and some of the oldest housing stock in all of America. You know, those 3-4-story tenement buildings that really supported the work of the mill and the early Franco-Americans. There was just so much to do, and how it all coordinated with how if you could demolish some buildings and build a parking lot. Well, that doesn't really matter, but if that parking lot supports the reinvestment of a building in the old Bates Mill, and you could put a pizza shop in there, and then that would support employment and workers, and then those workers had to find a place to live, and then you could go and rehab the other building back on Pine Street and get folks into that. It was really, really just, I fell in love with it. And then was lucky enough from there to go work for Maine State Housing Authority. I was a commercial underwriter and really got involved in the development work. We were building supportive housing group homes in partnership with the department, and we were building new affordable units, primarily using the low-income housing tax credit program, which is an IRS-driven program, really sort of a baby of Ronald Reagan and sort of trickle-down economics. And it was really sophisticated lending. And I just dove into it, and I was just so excited about the use of tax-exempt bonds and tax credits and all this stuff. And then for me, my big break was, Dana Topman at the time was the president of York Cumberland Housing, and he said, I'd love to have you come down to Gorham and help us do our development work. Dana since retired, and I was working with Jay Waterman, who now works for Portland Housing. And that little company moved to Portland and changed its name to Avesta Housing and is now the largest nonprofit developer in all of Maine. So was fortunate enough to grow up there, and Dana continued to give me opportunities. I ran ultimately at the end, was able to work closely with Jay, and then really sort of took over the real estate development, did a lot of new stuff in the Southern Maine area, and then was ultimately then given the responsibility of managing the management company. And I really wanted to learn both sides, because ultimately I wanted to have the job that I have today. And the reason I wanted to do that, and I loved my work at Avesta. It's an amazing company. Rebecca Hatfield now manages it well, and she's incredibly talented. But we had properties in 2 states and all counties, and I never felt like I could have an impact on any one neighborhood, because we were all just so geographically spread out. Mm-hmm. So when the opportunity in Bangor opened up, I was like, man, I'm just gonna throw my name in and kind of see what happens. And I was fortunate enough to get it. And what I love about my work now and my entire focus is I've changed us from a housing agency to a people agency. Yes, we're a housing authority and we're quasi-municipal and we collect rent and we pay our utilities and we do all that type of stuff. But our job and our obligation is to the folks that we serve. If you guys remember Bangor, Bangor Housing in our neighborhood is the largest public housing neighborhood north of Boston. And Ron, we bought the old airman housing when Dow Air Force Base closed. So we're a little unique in the sense that we have so many family units. We have at times up to close to 800, 900 school age kids, literally across the street from where I am now. That could be anywhere from, it could be 20% of Bangor's public school population on any given year, depending on enrollment. So we are incredibly resident driven. I couldn't be more excited about it where we are today.
Great. Thanks, Mike. Well, let's get some background a little bit, very briefly. Weston, you did a little bit of homework before we went on the air here. And give us just a little picture of public housing in the U.S. and how did it evolve? My understanding is that it goes back at least to the New Deal and getting out of the Depression. And the administration said housing is part of how we get the country back moving again. Tell us a little bit more background, if you can, Weston.
Certainly, Ron. It goes back a little further. It goes back into the 15, 1600s across the globe. Here in the United States, with the high levels of immigration happening, you end up with these tent communities and the public out of concern for health. You have movements, social movements, if you will, to address that and to create more stable housing, healthier housing for folks. So you end up having the first public housing property being built in Atlanta in 1935 or so. And at that point, you have a lot of various housing communities popping up that were public efforts in the 30s. Then we have the Great Depression happening, of course, and more effort has to be put into correcting things. You have folks struggling. So the Housing Act of 1937 comes out. And you get more public housing popping up at that point. Back then, it was workforce housing. It was that initial onset of how do we get people stabilized so they can work? We need folks contributing to society. They want to contribute to society. They have families to feed. And so you have that happening. It was working class, middle class folks who were being served by the initial efforts. Of course, that kind of transitions over time, right? You have the New Deal coming in then at that point, transition subsidized housing, which still kind of stands today with some of our efforts. You take your low-income housing tax credit program that Mike was speaking on, where we're creating more subsidized housing solutions, mixed income housing solutions, if you will. And it kind of carries on from there. HUD was created in 1965. So you have HUD starting to, the federal government kind of organizing their efforts a little bit more and creating a clearer picture of what is required, what's the need. Boy, then you have all kinds of social things happening. You have migrations out of cities and different programs coming out because now you got those properties that had existed becoming distressed, which we're now facing again. This is a cycle that has been going on and on, right? 60s and 70s, you have that's where you really see the turn from the public sector to including privatization of subsidized housing. Again, that's kind of carrying on into where we're at now. We see a lot of partnerships between public housing authorities and private entities, partnerships with community entities, nonprofits to address the problems we face with housing. Then another implementation in the 70s, you have the Section 8 program where the Housing Choice Voucher Program, as it's referred to now, is created. Folks can receive a voucher and go out and find housing in the public sector. All these efforts have really been built upon to where we're at now. Now we can no longer build public housing, but we have all these public housing buildings. A lot of folks are transitioning to what's referred to RAD as RAD. Mike, have you guys transitioned to RAD properties at all?
Basically, in Bangor, we do two things. We own and operate public housing, which is affordable housing for folks on a sliding scale of their income. They can come to us with zero income, and as their income grows, their rent increases. The other thing that we do is operate a housing choice voucher program. And what that means, Ron, is that we would be able to give a housing voucher to a participant, and they can take that anywhere else in Bangor and rent from a private landlord. So those are our two buckets. You may have heard the saying Section 8 housing. Well, Section 8 housing really is the housing choice voucher side of our work. Section 9 housing, which no one's ever heard of, is really public housing. So those two sections of the Housing Act are how we sort of live. And over the last couple of years, HUD has had a plan for the future of public housing. And their plan is to get out of it, because it's it's not sustainable in terms of the resources that are allocated from Congress and public. We seem to get less and less public housing dollars through Section 9 every year. But HUD says, hey, if you can convert from Section 9 to Section 8, you can do that through a program called RAD, which is the Rental Assistance Demonstration Program. And essentially, Ron, it's a very complicated, structure, but basically you flip a switch and all of a sudden on one day you go from receiving operating subsidy dollars from HUD to converting that project to project-based vouchers so that the tenants really see no difference in their rent is still based on their income. Their rent is still based on, where they live and qualifications. But for us as the agency, you can take federal property under Section 9 that you can't lien, that you can't mortgage. You can convert it to private ownership and use that asset to leverage private dollars. So now we can go out. Now we can go out, get a mortgage, do some different things. And it's going to change the future of all of our work.
We're getting into the weeds, which is great. But I want to bring us back in just a minute. I'll just remind listeners that they're tuned to Talk of the Towns. We're talking about housing authorities in Maine, their role, their current role, and some of the ways that they're innovating to solve some of these problems. We're talking with Michael Myhat, who is the executive director of the Bangor Housing, and Weston Bream, who is the executive director of the Mount Desert Island and Ellsworth Housing Authorities. Weston, I assume that you also have those two main focuses. You're providing some public housing, and then you have the rental assistance programs.
That's correct. Right?
Yeah. Yep. So, Liz, you want to pick it up here in terms of getting some more background?
Yeah, I'm going to jump. Well, so I'm going to follow up a little on what they've just both described about trends. So who do the property owners tend to be in properties where a transition has successfully been made from a publicly owned public housing development to one that will be supported by vouchers?
It can still be us, Liz.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we can either sell the property to a nonprofit that we sort of control, or the housing authority can still retain ownership. It would just be, you're relieving it of all those federal strings. So you can flat out sell it to another partner, another nonprofit, or the housing authority can still retain ownership, which is what we would prefer to do. Either through a long-term land lease or working with our affiliated nonprofit that we have.
Yeah, cool. So that leads me to another general question. Can a private, how does it tend to go if I own a building with four apartments in it? Can I choose whether or not I am interested in accepting vouchers, or am I required to?
Of course. So, yeah, the federal law says that no one can refuse participation in the Section 8 voucher program.
Okay.
However, if you're a landlord, and let's just say our two-bedroom voucher is $1,000, and your rent is $1,000, and you have you've taken a participant, you've gone through your screening, all that stuff works, then you can't just say no because they're a voucher holder.
Okay.
You can, however, say no if that applicant doesn't meet your screening criteria. It doesn't have good references, for example. Or a lot of times what we see that's more common, Liz, is the rent you're charging is $1,800 and the voucher just can't afford it. So it's not a yes or no. It's, you can't discriminate or you can't refuse participation, but landlords aren't required to accept it if it doesn't meet their criteria.
Mm-hmm. So that sounds like an answer to what I was thinking, which is why is it that it in most communities, you sort of know, I'm the general assistance administrator for my town because I'm the town clerk, so I have a little bit of a sense.
Yeah.
You know which properties are work with Section 8, and they, you know, it tends to be sort of one or a couple of places and nowhere else. And that sounds like it's why. It's because of a rent differential. Okay.
That's it. Yeah.
Cool.
Well, and there's rules to follow that, so if landlords have rent that's in that wheelhouse in that range, then a lot of our landlords love it because the majority of the rent comes directly from the housing agency. Mm-hmm. And that really helps them in terms of managing money and paying their bills because the rent is, you know, they know the rent's coming on the third or the fifth of the month whenever we wire it to them. And a lot of our landlords love that benefit.
Yeah, there's stability in our programs. I will say, Liz, though, a lot of times where a property is known, it's because there are other programs out there, right? A big one is the USDA Rural Development Program. You have properties out there. They also have income limitations. So their properties marry well with our the Housing Choice Voucher Program, for example.
Yeah. Weston, why don't you describe, you've got an interesting arrangement between two communities. You're housing director for Ellsworth and Mount Desert Island Housing Authorities. Describe that a little bit and the kind of people that you serve, the kinds of people.
Add an addendum to the question that I think Weston has the complicated job similar to our school superintendent of each of the four towns on Mount Desert Island has its own mini housing authority and its own board of commissioners. Is that right? So you get to work with all of them.
Yeah. So I have five boards of directors just from the housing authorities. And then we have a nonprofit that also has a board of directors. And then from the five housing authority boards, we have another board, the Management Advisory Committee. So seven boards technically. It's a little bit of a handful. With that said, building off of my experience and focus group management and whatnot, the fact that you have folks coming together who care about what's going on with the public housing portfolio within their municipalities, and it's organized in a manner that requires a board, it's actually, I like it. And I mean, it does take a lot of time, but it's my task to make it as efficient as possible. As far as the difference between them, there really isn't that big of a difference. They're all the boards are working towards the same goal of our mission to serve low income populations. I was quick to bring it to their attention upon my arrival that, you know, these housing authorities were created by your municipalities. You've been appointed by your elected officials to represent your communities. And there's a lot of things that a housing authority can do beyond just serving the low-income population. We can leverage our resources to help all of the community members, if you will. So that's a big direction that housing authorities are currently going with the mixed income housing solutions. And it's a matter of leveraging our programs that we have, our resources that we're currently working with, and creating more opportunity through those resources. And so everybody's on board with those ideas and realizing their responsibilities and where we currently stand within the context of need.
Cool. So back that more that direction in a minute, but we'd love to get some sort of images or vignettes from both of you. I loved thinking Mike looking out his window and seeing the community of kids who are served by your organization. So I'd love to know from both of you what different family structures are there? Are there friends who live together or what? Obviously, without getting into any confidentiality issues, but just who are served by your programs in
Yeah, I can go first. First, Liz. So, our housing is primarily two, three bedroom townhouses. So, the overwhelming majority of our head of households are single parents, mostly single moms, with probably on average two children. Most of them are either working part time or full time, or trying to go to school, or in many cases, doing both and trying to juggle that. So I guess that would be sort of the, and we also have a smaller population of housing for seniors and for some folks who are disabled, but it's really the minority of our portfolio.
I'm quite opposite. The majority of my portfolio is elderly disabled. We have a few family units, and those would be similar to what Mike's portfolio has, a lot of single parents with two or three kids. But out of my units, I have 254 public housing units and 24 multifamily HUD units. Don't be tricked by multifamily. It doesn't mean they're family units. They are elderly disabled units. So what do I got? Maybe 24 of those are family units. And the rest of them are elderly disabled.
Yeah. And Liz, that's probably the way Western is describing his portfolio is really what mirrors sort of the nation for most places. We're just unique because we bought the old Air Force base.
Right.
That's what makes us really unique.
Right. So each of you have kind of noted that you're serving people. And so in addition to housing, you're probably doing some other things or at least facilitating some other services for the folks who you're serving. Mike, can we start with you and talk a little bit about some of that? And I know Weston has some other examples.
Sure, I'd love to, Ron. That's the most thing we're most proud of is our resident services team, which almost is our largest division now within the agency. And so things that we do are encourage people to improve their lives. We did a survey a long time ago of what residents really wanted. And a lot of what they said was they don't want to live in public housing, but they kind of have to just because of what's going on in their life. So how do they get out? Well, public housing residents, a lot of our residents have lived here generationally with their parents. So generational poverty is a really big thing. So by providing folks with opportunities to either go back to school, finish their high school diploma or start college, learn about different career opportunities. We started at something called a Career Exploration Academy with Eastern Maine Community College, where we bring cohorts of adults, work-able adults in, and we bring them to different companies. Like we brought them to the airport, for example, and the airport says, yes, we have planes, but we also have a marketing team. We process payroll. We have ticket counter folks. So we went to different agencies, went to the hospital and did that, went to other organizations to open folks' eyes to different type of career opportunities. The largest program we offer is something called family self-sufficiency. In America, someone in subsidized housing, whenever they increase their income, we increase their rent. So someone doesn't necessarily get ahead by working. They can sometimes even go behind because now they've got childcare and transportation costs. So in the family self-sufficiency program, so let's just say, Liz and Ron, you're living with us. You're on $50 a rent. You go and you get a better job or get more hours. Your rent goes up to $200. Well, that's a lot. That's a big increase all of a sudden. But if you've worked with our team, a coach, and developed a set of goals for yourself, and the end goal is meaningful employment, you still pay the increased $200, but the difference goes into a bank account for you, Ron, and it's set aside. So when you graduate with your goals and you get that job that you wanted, you get to keep that resource. And for young families, that's the motivation to keep going. That's the Ron, you're getting that extra $150. Yes, you're paying it, but it's a bank account that you're going to set up, and you can sometimes have a reserve or savings of, let's just say, $12,000-$15,000, and maybe that's enough for you, Ron, to then go buy that home. That's enough for the down payment. And we've had 26 families so far graduate. That we've had many more graduate, but 26 have gone out and bought a home. Our goal is we want you to leave public housing forever and never come back and never, ever let your kids come back. And I'll say one final piece. We have our largest partner is the Boys and Girls Club of Bangor. I told you how many kids we have. And the Boys and Girls Club provides a free and safe place for kids to go before school and after school. So you know, Ron, you've got that new job. You can drop your kids off at the club. The club will make sure your kids get to school. And that school, they've got partnerships with the Bangor School Department, whether it's Down East or other schools in the area. The school will bring your kid directly to the club after school. And you know why that's important? Because the kid gets positive mentoring. They get healthy activities. You know, they can learn how to be positive role models in their community. But more importantly, Ron, that lets you continue to work.
Important. Really important. That,
those two without the club, and we do what's called a two-generational approach. We just presented this at a national conference of housers in Orlando, and it's really starting to sort of catch on. There's not many of us in America that do that two-generational approach, but we found it's really the best way to serve the family.
Right. Weston, how about you in terms of the kinds of programs? You have a different population you're serving. Tell us a little bit more about the other kinds of ancillary programs.
Certainly, but before I go into my own little world here, I got to commend Mike and Bangor Housing for running that family self-sufficiency program. Ron, Liz, listeners, you all don't really understand how complicated that program is to run it, to be successful with it, to put in all the effort that you have to put into it to have successes. It takes a lot. But the value of it, you're breaking generational poverty. That has an immense value to society and to the community that Mike is serving. So given our population that we serve being elderly disabled, we also have a similar program. It's a self-sufficiency program under tenant services where we go in and we assist elderly and disabled folks with various daily activities to ensure independent living. That's one program that we've been successful with and continue to provide. Additionally, under our nonprofit, the Acadia Community Association, we run a Meals on Wheels program. We have a kitchen on one of our properties, has a full-time cook and some part-time staff. They serve on average 20,000 meals on the island alone a year. It does not serve off of the island. The program isn't coordinated in partnership with I'm going to blank on their name. This is where I'm the new guy.
Eastern Area Agency on Aging or something like that. Yeah.
There you go. We have those programs going on. We also tap into another federal funding. I believe it's federal, the Comfortably Home program, where we go into folks in the community who are not in our program in any other way. And we provide different upgrades to their houses, install grab bars, put in ADA ramps if possible. Again, to focus on independent living and to in hopes of allowing for an individual to continue aging in place. Other than that, I mean, those are mainly the programs that we're offering at this point.
Yeah. So something I want to do is put a question from each of you to the other. So first for Mike, Weston mentioned the various boards that he works with. And at the very top, you mentioned working with people and for people, that people are what you're doing more than housing is what you're doing. And so what are the ways in which participants and residents are involved and have a voice in the leadership of Bangor Housing?
A couple different ways for us. Maine statute requires us to have 2 of our 7 commissioners be residents or participants in our program. So we have 2 public housing residents that are part of a 7-member board of commissioners. And we also have a resident council. So that resident council meets monthly. They meet, I think, on the first Tuesday of every month in the evening. We provide a space for them to meet in the community where they come together as community members, and our staff are there as well. And they talk about things that are issues, concerns, things that they want to do in the neighborhood. A specific project that came out of that was called a project called Dumpster Days. A lot of our folks, you know, you buy a bed and then what do you do with the old mattress? Well, if someone, you know, has a car and a trailer, they would be able to bring that to their local transfer station and take care of it. But if you live in public housing and you don't have a car and you don't have a trailer, the old mattress just sits in your basement. So they were like, hey, could Bangor Housing get a couple dumpsters and set them up for the week, and we can have dumpster days. Cool. And tenants can bring their trash to the central office. And that's exactly what we had. Any given day, we'd have 5 big roll-offs. And it was, you know, folks were literally like, they would rent a U-Haul and get their stuff here. We'll throw it away for you for free if you can just get it here. And I know that sounds kind of silly, but if you don't have the means to get the mattress thrown away, it just sits in your basement. And that creates hazards.
That's awesome.
So we paid for the dumpster, but it benefited us because we got rid of all that extra stuff. And the residents really loved it, one, because they came up with the idea and they did the work in terms of getting it here. So that's typically the involvement we'll see with our residents.
Nice. So then for Weston, it was cool because I'm like harkening back to moments. I saw this big gleams in both of your eyes. Mike is obviously rightly very proud of and excited about the 2-generation approach and that work. So I wanted to put to you, what are you proudest of and most excited about in what you're working on?
I am a process person. So being that this is my second agency, I'm getting to see things in a different light. Things are done different in every housing authority. So I'm always excited about organizational psychology and how I can make something operate more efficiently. Ultimately, I am excited about that mostly. Coming here, it's a new palette, if you will, and I've been getting things in order, pulling some functionality that we have to engage in constantly. I'm pulling it in-house, identifying strengths within existing staff, bringing forth my own experiences in program management to basically affect cost savings for the agency that then can be used to better serve the properties that, and take care of them. So that's a big piece that I'm excited about, and I'm taking it on head on. So I'm basically just currently just focused on that. I can't even think beyond that at this point. And but ultimately, you know, we're helping folks. Another piece I'm really excited about is being part of a larger solution. I'm constantly thinking about a larger housing initiative plan, using the housing authorities all as a whole, and what resources we have available for us. So basically, I'm focused on getting everything in place to facilitate that down the road, knowing that there's some major opportunities that we can tap into with current funding streams, low-income housing tax credits, going out and meeting people, getting involved with different housing initiatives in the area to ensure that I am capturing the need. That's what's driving me at this point.
Great. I'll just remind listeners that they're tuned to Talk of the Towns this afternoon, and we're talking about housing authorities in Maine. Just heard from Weston Bream, who is the executive director of the Mount Desert Island and Ellsworth Housing Authorities, and Mike Myhart is the executive director of the Bangor Housing Authority, or Bangor Housing, it's called now. Liz, where do you want to take this conversation now?
Yeah. So more about funding in a minute, but first, another thing that you know, Maine is large, and even WRU's listening area is large. So something I always think about as a radio listener is, okay, well, if I'm not in a place where this happens, how does this affect me? So what's the role of state organizations, Maine State Housing, and how would you say that if your listeners in areas not covered by a housing authority, what would you say their role in it is? Like, how would they find out more, or why does it matter to folks who don't live in a place with a housing authority?
Maybe Mike to start. Mike, sure. To start. Yeah.
So this really has a lot to do with the administration of the voucher program. So local housing authorities have a jurisdiction, and that jurisdiction is not just for Bangor. My jurisdiction includes Herman, Hamden, Glenburn, and Veazey. So if I have a voucher, that's where I can go. Well, what happens if someone's in Newport? An area that's outside of a local PHA's jurisdiction is managed by Maine Housing. So anyone in Maine or anyone in America can apply for a housing choice voucher. In Maine, we have one place that everyone can go. It's affordablehousing.com, and you can apply for a voucher. It's one application, and you can enter in all your information for yourself or for your mother or your father. And you can check a town that you want to be in. You want to live in Westbrook? Do you want to live in Bangor? Do you want to live in Caribou? It's one application, and you check the boxes. And then what's cool about that is the software sorts the preferences. So in Bangor, we have a senior housing preference. Remember, all of my public housing is for families. I want to be able to serve seniors, and I feel like I can do that through the voucher program. You got to be 62 or older, and you'll get a voucher before someone under the age of 62. So outside of our jurisdiction, that voucher program relies on the administration from Maine State Housing, and they would have the most vouchers of anyone in Maine just because of their largest jurisdiction. Portland is obviously second. I think we might be fourth. We're pretty close in terms of size as it relates to Lewiston.
So you could live in Newport if you found a unit. You would just be working directly with Maine State Housing. Is that how it works?
Basically, cool. Yes. There's a lot of intricacies in terms of if I have a voucher in a local jurisdiction, after you've lived in that local jurisdiction for a year, you can go somewhere else, Liz. So if you've lived in Bangor for a year and you decide that you want to follow your job to Connecticut, you can take the voucher to Connecticut if you want. That's what's the beauty about the voucher program is it's portable so that tenants can take the voucher and follow the job or the opportunities across America. How it's administrated, it is not necessarily that important today, but that's the cool part about the voucher program is it can move with the tenant. Mm-hmm.
And Weston, you described your desire to be part of a larger set of solutions in terms of housing. And I know that you participated in a housing summit on Mount Desert Island, and that's an example of trying to figure out how do we figure out housing for everybody.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, ultimately, that's why housing authorities were created, right? Is that there was an identified need to assist. And as we were going through the history, you go back to, wow, it started off as workforce housing. And here we are again. Workforce housing is a big conversation piece, especially here on Mount Desert Island. It seems to be in heightened a bit, but ultimately this is a problem nationwide. It's everywhere. It's everywhere in Maine. So, you know, to build off of what Mike was saying, most housing authorities have also created nonprofit arms, development corporations, housing corporations, they're often called. As I stated, we have off of the Mount Desert Island Ellsworth Housing Authorities, we have the Acadia Community Association. That has been the vehicle in the past to help out with different development opportunities. And the nonprofits often have a larger jurisdiction to that they can serve. So, like, for example, if somebody is looking at in Hancock County, I'm being Pennsylvania here. I think on the county level often. I see Trenton, and I right away I'm like, oh, okay, well, ACA can come in there and assist possibly with some housing needs.
And that's between Mount Desert Island and Ellsworth, and that's why correct. Trenton comes to mind. If they're not being served currently in the jurisdictions of the housing authority.
Right, and they currently do not have a housing authority. Mike, can you establish a housing authority now, or is it just a moot point that nobody would even navigate it? Because you can't.
I don't think so.
Public housing.
Yeah, Congress established something called a fair cloth limit, which means for Bangor we have 567 public housing units. You will never ever get any more than that.
Yeah, public housing is done. So. The public housing agency, that model, I think, is done as well. With
but
that said, you have the
affordable housing on a different model. Post Reagan, incentives went to developers to keep construction costs down, to keep loans down, which ultimately reduced expenses, which was allowed to enable rents to just be naturally lower. So prior to that, the government subsidized people where you were going to get a voucher and it didn't matter what it costs. You were just going to pay, 30% of your income to your rent. Now the model is you have to pay the full rent. It's just below market. And that's what we're looking at in terms of affordable housing today. It's a very different fundamental shift, but the days of being able to provide vouchers to folks is just, it's too expensive. Too expensive.
So as you look at some of the challenges going forward under this new model, where do you see some bright lights? Where do you see yourself innovating to solve the problem? Mike's to start maybe, and then go to Weston in terms of how you're responding to these changes.
Absolutely, Ron. And I think the biggest thing that we want to say is we want to thank the last session of the Maine legislature for the unprecedented amount of dollars they put toward affordable housing, including Governor Mills for putting large amounts in her budget and sticking to it. And without that support, the work that's going on by agencies like Avesta and Developers Collaborative and people all over Maine, it just wouldn't be happening. And then, you start to see some stuff on the local level that, like Weston has a lot of stuff going on the island where you've got some out-of-state developers, out-of-state residents trying to stop construction of new workforce housing. So that stuff's kind of always been around, Ron. But the light at the end of the tunnel is the Maine legislature understands that we're in a housing crisis. We have a governor that understands we're in a housing crisis. And if we don't start doing something about it, all of our young people are going to go somewhere else. And so that I couldn't be more proud of the work that the legislature did and just putting so much money on the street for people to build stuff. And it's starting to happen. Stuff's going up all the time.
Weston, how would you respond to that question of some of the challenges you're seeing in this arena and how you think you might be able to respond?
I'm the new guy, Ron, right? So
but you've got lots of experience coming from Pennsylvania.
Still figuring it all out. With that said, I mean, from what I'm seeing and how organized the public housing directors are in Maine and how they're working with the state to influence some of the legislation that comes out or at least be part of the conversation. In the states, the players that are involved are interested in hearing the voice of the housing authority. So there's a relationship there that is well established. I assume it's always been, which is fascinating to see and to understand how that can influence the path forward. And everybody's working on it. We have the resources available. There's a lot of great work being done. One thing I worry about is how competitive it becomes. You get a lot of folks trying to do the same thing. So it really takes folks on the community level to come together and work together. So they're not competing against one another. They're coming up with solutions that fit their communities.
One thing that if I could add, Ron and Liz, the majority of Mainers are retired. We're an old state on average. So my theory is if we can build a home, an affordable place to live, an apartment for a Maine senior, that allows maybe that woman who's lost her husband to move out of that house that her and her husband lived in for 50 years and raise their kids in, because they don't need the house in a Bangor Tree Street neighborhood anymore. And once she moves into an affordable housing project, she can live there as long as she's able to. You know, she's got mobility, she's got grab bars in the shower, she's safe, she doesn't have to mow the lawn. Well, the cool part of that is that single family home on that Tree Street neighborhood is now available to maybe a first time home buyer family. And then you know what happens? The apartment that young family moved out of, Ron, is now available to a young person that just graduated. So if we can build affordable senior housing, it really is a 3-for-1. And that, for me, that also ties into our labor pool. If you've got 10 people in Maine that were work able, 6 of them are retired. I'm just using an example. A couple of them are children. So you've got 2 people in the workforce for what used to be 8 or 10. So if we can move seniors into a safe place to live and free up some of these existing homes, that's how we continue to support and build our younger labor pool.
That's great. And you've each talked about the role of the private sector playing an increasing role here. Any accolades that you want to throw out in terms of how examples you've seen where that's particularly worked well? And Mike, you've got probably some good examples there.
Two of them that I really think are really innovative and not necessarily directly related to new housing, but the work Jackson Lab did for providing childcare on the island. And then I think you just heard the recent announcement that BIW is doing the same thing at the Bath
Y.
So our waiting list, our housing crisis has always been there, never changed. The difference is you're starting to see people like BIW, Darlings and Quirk and all in Northern Light and Jackson Lab. Now they're starting to see it as well. Poor people have always been on a waiting list and never had an affordable place to live. That's never changed. But the bank trying to recruit the executive to come up from Florida can't find a place he wants to bring his family to. So the housing crisis has started to affect people of all incomes now, which is why it was in the BDN as a front page story almost every day over the past summer. It's a big deal.
Right.
And if we.
And that's why the legislature is paying attention, is that they're hearing from constituents all the time about this situation. Yeah.
And that is the power of the people right there. And the legislature did what they needed to. And I'm hoping that this will continue to be a thing because everyone's talking about it. Everyone knows someone that needs, that has a housing story, regardless of income.
Liz, you get to ask the last question. It's your favorite question.
It is. I'm psyched because we've really been going this direction for the last several minutes that we've gotten to this great space of hope and possibility. But in our last couple minutes, just what's one thing you wish more people knew about housing authorities or housing and what you do?
I'll start that off. The amount of work that we put into serving every individual that is under our programs, the dedication of staff, it goes beyond property management. They are social workers. They're assisting. We're in the, I don't want to call it a business, but We are providing housing. We're trying to keep people housed. The last thing we want to do is evict people and go through the processing that is required with that. That kind of work, it can consume you just as well. And we have limited administrative capacity. I think it's really important that folks realize that we put in a lot of work to take care of our residents and those who are participating in our programs.
Thanks, Weston. Mike, how would you answer that question?
I'd say exactly what Weston did. I just would also add that folks that live in public housing live there, you know, most of them because they have to, because of a situation that's brought them there. But they are working hard, at least in our portfolio. I know the data. They're working hard because they want to get out and they want a better life for themselves and a better life for their kids. And our sole obligation is to make sure that primarily the children that we're serving in our public housing have those opportunities, because they can't control where they were born. But what they can control is what they want to do in the future of their lives, but they don't know what they don't know. So providing opportunities to all of our residents is the biggest thing we do. And I just think the general public may not necessarily get to see that.
Right. Great. Well, thank you both for what a stimulating conversation. We've come to the end of the hour. Be sure and join us from 4 to 5 on the second Wednesday afternoon of each month for Talk of the Towns. Podcasts of our programs can be found in the archive section of the WERU website. If you have comments or suggestions for other topics, please email us at news@weru.org. Our theme music is a medley from Coronach on a Balnain House Highland music recording. And thanks again so much to our guests this afternoon, Weston Bream is the executive director of the Mount Desert Island and Ellsworth Housing Authorities, and Michael Myhat is the executive director of Bangor Housing. Thanks to our underwriters. Thanks to Joel Mann for helping to engineer our program. Stay tuned for Ralph Nader Radio from 5 to 6 and The Groove Shop from 6 to 8. Liz Graves and I are producers and hosts for Talk of the Towns. This is Ron Beard wishing you a good afternoon.